Baking can seem like magic. Mix four or five ingredients together, add heat, and transform kitchen basics into fragrant breads, delicious cakes, and other beautiful sustaining foods. Of course, what happens isn't magic, it's chemistry. And understanding even a little about what's going on when you combine ingredients and add heat can make you a much more successful and satisfied baker. So in today's Please Explain segment, as part of our Food Friday series, we are going to talk about the science of baking with Chef Scott McMillan, a pastry art instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education in New York City, and Shirley O. Currier, who began her career as a biochemist with Vanderbilt University Medical School and has become a world-renowned expert in the field of the science of cooking. She's the author of Bake Wise, The Hows and Whys of Successful Cooking. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And as always on these Please Explain segments, we invite you to join the discussion. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692. Write us on our show page at WNYC.org, on Facebook, or on Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And I'm very pleased to welcome both Scott and Shirley to our show today. Hello.
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 Shirley, baking involves indirect as opposed to direct heat. It's kind of a slower, gentler heat. Is baking like chemistry, where you can mix a number of very different ingredients together and come up with something unlike any of them?
Absolutely. You can have a minimum of ingredients, such as French bread, and still have amazing differences.
Fresh bread being flour, water, and salt.
Right, right. French bread. Sometimes sourdough leaveners, yeast from the air.
That's free yeast. You don't even have to buy those little packets.
It's free yeast. You don't even have to buy it.
Does the Fleischmann Company know about that?
They certainly do, and they use some of this free yeast out of the air in producing some of their products even. So who knows? Some bakeries wouldn't dare clean up the place too much because they count on that yeast in the atmosphere, actually, the old bakeries in Paris, for example,
And Scott, does that happen at your school?
Oh yes, yeah. We teach a bread program and we teach bread baking to our students, and we're constantly having wild yeast cultures go on and leaving it exposed for periods of time.
Now, what is the advantage or disadvantage of using wild yeast as opposed to the commercial yeast?
The advantage would be that the flavors, as the yeast acts, you get that sour flavor because it takes really weeks to cultivate it inside of your starter, and you need to feed it on a daily basis with fresh flour, which is food for the yeast, and the water, which is also food for the yeast. And one of the byproducts of the yeast, aside from the carbon dioxide that's being created, is acids, to a degree, alcohol, but not so much, because you don't have quite that time that you would get for that. But the acids create the...
So, Shirley, should I assume that there's wild yeast right here in my radio studio?
Absolutely.
And it's everywhere.
I did want to say one thing. You know, I spent years trying to make really good sourdough starters and so forth, but my big breakthrough came when I started adding a little bit, just a tablespoon even, of rye flour. It seems that there's some bugs and things in rye that really, at least in my household, encourage the little bugs that are in the air.
I want to get to flour in just a moment, but I was wondering, has every culture developed a form of baking? And do we know how long humans have been baking?
Oh, my. I'll pass, Scott. Do you know exactly? It's for thousands of years.
Yeah. I know on the earliest I've heard, I'm not sure of when the dates are, but years ago I've read of an archaeological dig in China where it was one of those situations where a volcano, the lava kind of embalmed everybody all at once, and they found the remains of a woman carrying a pot, and inside the pot was noodles made from millet. So not necessarily baking, but people have been working with grains since they started farming and cultivating.
We're talking about baking on today's Please Explain as part of our Food Friday series with Chef Scott McMillan, a pastry art instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education, New York City, and Shirley O'Currier, who is not only a biochemist, but also the author of Bakewise, The Hows and Whys of Successful Cooking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And if you want to get into this conversation, our number here is 212-433-9692. So let's start talking about flour. Mm-hmm. Scott, there are dozens of varieties, but it is the most basic aspect of most baking, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
So what is flour?
Well, when we talk about baking, primarily we're talking about wheat flour. Wheat flour could be any grain that has been milled to basically a powdery form. But wheat flour has some very unique properties. White flour comes from the endosperm of the kernel, which is the starchy interior. In fact, it's roughly 85% starch. The remaining ingredient or component, rather, of the endosperm are two proteins that are game changers, basically, when it comes to baking, glutenin and gliadin. When they become wet, they form a composite protein called gluten. And gluten changes characteristics as you mix it and adds elasticity and chewiness to breads.
And, of course, now there are a lot of people who are demanding gluten-free products. We'll get to that
exactly
in a little bit. But, Shirley, how much variation is there within the same category of flour? Do they have different levels of protein content depending on where they come from?
Absolutely. In the South, the wheat is planted in the winter, and the normal wheat, there's both soft winter wheat and hard winter wheat, but these wheats are grown in areas that the ground does not freeze more than 10 inches during the winter. In the northern plains in Canada, you have the spring wheat, which are very, very high in protein. And now another reason this protein content that Scott was telling you about is so important: when those two proteins, glutenin and gliadin, combine, they grab water and each other to make these springy elastic sheets of gluten, this bubble gum like stuff. And see, yeast oozes out a liquid, and when this liquid touches a bubble in the dough, it releases carbon dioxide gas and alcohol, and it blows up this gluten network just like somebody blowing up bubble gum. But this vital thing, if you've got a high-protein flour, remember, when those two proteins combine, they grab water first and then each other, and they literally, a high-protein flour will suck in the water like crazy, whereas a low protein flour will not.
So, and Scott, maybe I should ask you this. When we generally see in the supermarket is all purpose flour, does the protein content vary depending on whether you're using a store brand or a high price flour like King Arthur?
Well, more than just the protein content, but usually, say, all purpose is around 10 to 11% protein. And that should be across the board. It's a good way of understanding the strength of the flour that you're using.
So why is King Arthur so much more expensive or some of the other specialty flours?
Well, I'm not exactly sure how they run their product, but I know they're a smaller, small batch mill. I don't know that they go into the bleaching process, which speeds up production. So that you can move more product faster. So they probably put a little more care and time into making their flours, and they pay more attention to things that most people don't have to worry about, ash content and so on.
Now, Shirley, isn't flour different in France than it is in this country or other countries as well? When we're adapting a recipe, do we have to be aware of that?
Absolutely. Back to the high protein and low protein. You see, if someone writing the recipe was using a low-protein flour, like some of the European flours or the French flours. Or Southern flours. And then someone following the recipe is using a high-protein flour. They're going to have this, you know, see that high-protein it's drying up that batter in the dough or the dough, and they're going to have a miserably dry product. Now, unfortunately, there can be a wide range of all-purpose, like a Southern all-purpose can be about 8 grams of protein per cup of flour, whereas a Northern all-purpose can be as high as 13 grams of protein.
But they don't put that on the package. I don't know when I buy that Pillsbury or the White Rose flour in my supermarket, whether it's from the North or the South.
Well, what is on your package is I considered it a great tragedy. They used to put the protein content by 1/4 of a cup. Mm-hmm. So they would say 2 grams per 1/4 of a cup. And you knew you had an 8 gram per cup low protein flour. Or if it said 3 grams per 1/4 of a cup, you had 12 grams of sort of an intermediate. Or if they said 4 grams, you had a high protein. But nowadays, they've rounded it off to 1 cup. And practically all flour is 3 grams per cup because they apply the round-off rule. So you don't know what on earth you've got. Now, you could tell by water absorption, and they used to tell the story of old German bakers who would take a sweaty arm and shove it in a barrel of unknown flour, and if a lot of flour stuck to his arm, he knew it was a high-protein flour.
I'll have to try that at home. Well, Scott, if a recipe calls for 12 ounces of all-purpose flour, can I mix in rye flour, some whole wheat flour, and still get a satisfactory result?
You can. You can to a degree. I wouldn't go...
Cake flour?
When cake has a very low protein content. Generally, when a student asks me if they want to use usually wheat flour to get the whole grain health and nutrition in there, you can substitute as much as 1/3 of the flour, but it will affect the results. You may want to go with a stronger flour, like a bread flour, if you're going to cut some of the, if you say 12 ounces of all-purpose flour, you're going to add in another 3 or 4 ounces of wheat flour. You would use maybe a higher gluten bread flour.
We have a caller, Caroline from East Orange, New Jersey, who's baking as we speak. You have a problem, Caroline?
I do. I'm following a recipe, and the recipe called for 3 cups of sugar. And when I made the cake the last time, it was very sweet, so I just added 2.5 cups. But I'm having a problem to getting my sugar and butter to cream until it's light and fluffy with just the 2.5 cups. Could that be a problem?
Scott, isn't sugar also used to create volume as well as sweetness?
Yeah. When you're creaming your butter and your sugar together. How much butter are you using?
I'm using 3 sticks.
3 sticks to 2.5 cups of butter.
Right.
So as you cream it, there might not be enough moisture content in the butter to really dissolve all of the sugar over a while. But as the butter and the sugar are mixing, the grains of sugar are acting as little tiny paddles along with the paddle to break it up and to aerate it.
Okay.
So if it's not dissolving yet, at some point you're going to add liquids such as eggs or milk to it, I assume. Just get it to where the color is light and it's starting to take on something of a buttercream type frosting, spreadable type consistency.
Okay. Yeah.
And then add your eggs a little gradually to that, and a little bit of liquid will help it to dissolve before it's all done.
No, I wasn't ready to talk about butter yet. Go ahead, Shirley.
Yeah, one problem. If you have your butter too warm, it starts melting. It's not visible, terribly visible, but it's vital to keep your butter cold enough because when it melts, there goes your leavening, your bubbles. I know frequently in a hot southern kitchen, you literally have to take your bowl off the mixer and put it in the freezer a couple of minutes and then pull it back out.
Now, and we've been talking about differences in flours. What about butters? Because you can get everything from a store brand to European-style butters, mm-hmm. and everything else. How important is the kind of butter you use? Can you use any butter and still get good results in baking?
The higher the fat content in the butter, the better the creaming you'll get with it. Most American supermarket brand butters are around the 80%. So if and a European style butter would be around 83%. It might not sound like much, 3% fat, but that's 3% less water generally that's in the mix. So if you're using a lower fat butter, and when you come to add your eggs and your liquids, you're worried about emulsification, fats and liquids suspended and blended smoothly together. So the higher the fat content, the less water is in the butter, the more ingredient you could add to the butter.
And we'll get to the eggs and whether butter can, we can find substitutes for butter and whatever else comes up, and your calls and your comments after we take a little break. My guests are Scott McMillan, who's a pastry art instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education in New York City, and Shirley O. Carrier, who began her career as a biochemist at Vanderbilt University Medical School and now has become an expert in the field of the science of cooking. Our number, 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Tweet us at Leonard Lopate, or write in on our Facebook. There's so many different ways to reach us. It's amazing. And we are back with our Please Explain segment, looking at baking, with Shirley O. Carrier, who is both a biochemist and an expert in the science and cooking. Her book, Bake Wise, The Hows and Whys of Successful Cooking, published by Simon & Schuster. And Scott McMillan, who's a pastry art instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education, New York City, on 23rd Street, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Also, you can write us at WNYC.org. Before we get to them, because I still would like to just deal as quickly as possible with some of the basics, eggs. Certain kinds of eggs preferable for baking? Does it matter if you're using very fresh, recently laid eggs or the ones that have been in the refrigerator for a couple of weeks?
Could I add one thing to the creaming? The young lady who called in is absolutely correct to be concerned with creaming, because, you see, this is the major volume of your cake is produced in the creaming. And the pastry chef and writer who wrote The Art of the Cake, Bruce Healy, through experimentation, he discovered that you get increase in volume when you whip the butter alone. Of course, it has to be cold enough to hold those air bubbles. And when you whip the butter with the sugar, but once you add the eggs, you don't get any increase in volume. So it is vital to whip some air into the butter and to the butter and sugar before you add the eggs, because the total volume of your cake is affected only by the whipping the butter or the butter and the sugar. That stunned me when I read that in Bruce.
Now, Shirley, since we're talking about eggs, do you like the fresh ones, or is it okay if they've been sitting in the refrigerator for a while? And does it matter if they're large or small or all those other things?
Well, I really, really like to use very fresh eggs. And a fresh egg, the albumin, the white, is quite thick and clings to the yolk. So this will give you a beautiful poached egg and a beautiful fried egg. As the egg gets older, it loses its acidity through their 17,000 pores in the egg, little baby holes. And a lot of carbon dioxide seeps out through those little holes. And so your egg becomes more and more alkaline. And this does make major changes. The egg white is going to be easier to whip, but it's going to be more stable if it's fresh and a little harder to whip.
Now, Scott, what roles do the yolk and the white play in baking?
Well, the yolk is primarily fat, and the
But it also adds protein, doesn't it?
It has a lot of protein in it as well. It has an emulsifier in it called lecithin, which helps blend ingredients smoothly, which is
so
very important.
You want to mix melted butter smoothly, it might be a good idea to do it with the egg yolk, because then it won't break up when it hits the cold ingredients?
Melted butter, I don't often use melted butter. If I'm making a pastry, I usually want to keep the butter somewhat cold, because that has to do with how it coats the flour and so on.
In
aerating, exactly. Melted butter isn't going to aerate. And it's also, because it's wet, it's gonna mess with the flour differently.
Now, eggs are also the main ingredient in flourless cakes. How do they substitute for flour?
Well, the eggs have proteins in it, too, that also set when in contact with heat. So they will, as it bakes, they have that solidifying, gelatinizing ability as well as flour, but not to the same degree.
Now, surely people who don't bake all that often aren't always clear about the differences between baking soda and baking powder, and also, I guess, double-acting baking powder. Can we use them interchangeably?
Actually, baking soda is the active ingredient. So one tablespoon of baking powder has a fourth of a tablespoon of soda as its active ingredient. And it also has an acid, one or two acids, that react with the soda to produce leavening, and it has a little cornstarch to keep it all dry. But the different brands of baking powder have different acids in them. And some of these acids react immediately and produce bubbles instantly, and others don't react until the dough gets hot in the oven, and those will give you your double acting. Some of the acid reacts with the soda to produce bubbles instantly when you mix it, but then the other doesn't until it gets hot in the oven.
And then when you use too much of that stuff, it tastes awful.
Oh, well, that's baking soda. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It has that horrible metallic taste. Now, the great advantage of using baking powder is that it has exactly the right amount of acid to neutralize all of that soda. So you will never have a horrible aftertaste from baking powder.
Let's take some calls. Gwen from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for this program. I am gluten tolerant, so I've been playing around with different gluten breads and mixing almond flour with it, and I'm trying to find, I'm making scones and I've made them probably 10 times. So I'm wondering what the ratio, if it's 1 3/4 cup of a gluten-free flour with the agent that binds it, and then how much almond flour I would be using.
You want to take that?
You got a suggestion.
Well, a lot of baking is trial and error when you're trying to figure out a way to change a recipe. So, again, almond flour, even though it's called flour, it's not a true flour. It's not a grain. It doesn't have the starches. It's ground almonds. So it has a lot of oils in it that are great, and they also add moisture to a baked product. So that's one thing you have to take into consideration. Again, I would remove another dry ingredient, one of the starches, and replace it with some of the almond flour and see how that does. And if it's a little too soft, if it breaks apart too easily, maybe add more starch time you make
it. In recent years, we've been seeing a bunch of cookbooks for gluten-free diets. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether spelt is gluten-free, but we also see spelt often offered as an alternative to wheat flours. Is something lost when you're not using a wheat flour or a rye flour?
Well, it depends on the end product. If you're making a pastry dough where you don't want a lot of gluten development in it, you could make a very nice substitution with gluten-free ingredients, brown rice flour, spelt, and so on. However, where it really suffers if you try and recreate a bread, where you want that chewiness, which is a direct result of the elasticity that gluten gives you. And you could try using gums to trap the air bubbles, which is also what gluten does as the dough rises and expands. It's the gluten that contains the air cells so that it can rise. And to, a lot of gluten-free recipes will look for substitutes as far as gums, like xanthan gum, I think, is quite frequently used.
Wendy, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling because I know there's some people who might want to substitute for the butter. And even with an old recipe that I have from the 50s, a cake that my mother used to make for me and now I make for my son, if you just substitute unsweetened applesauce, 1-to-1, if it's whatever the amount of butter, put the same amount of applesauce in, and the cake is wonderful. It's the same taste.
Do you subscribe to that? Many people have called butter the cement of baking.
Yeah.
It strikes me as that's more likely than applesauce being a cement.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know applesauce is used a lot to replace fats in low-fat cooking. The thing that I love about fat, I mean, is how it affects the flavor. You know, fat, when you mix fat in, there's that saying, fat is flavor. The fat itself might not be the flavor, but it does hold the flavors. And if it's a low melting fat like butter, as soon as it hits your palate, it melts and distributes the flavor.
A listener, Jamie, go ahead, Shirley.
A quick technical word here. The reason that applesauce can be substituted for the butter, one of the roles of fat in baking is to tenderize. Remember those two little proteins, glutenin and gliadin, and how they grab water in each other to make gluten? When you add the fat, you grease these little fellows, and they can no longer grab water or each other. So the gluten is not formed, and this tenderizes. Now, it just so happens that concentrations of sugar will, instead of glutenin and gliadin combining with each other, glutenin runs off with sugar, gliadin runs off with sugar, and so these protein sugar compounds are formed, and you don't get as much gluten. So applesauce, or pureed prunes, the famous chocolate prune cake, these are forms of sweetener, and they will tenderize, so they take the role of tenderizing that butter had.
Now, what about milk? A lot of people don't even have whole milk in their houses anymore, or they don't have whole buttermilk in their house. Does it matter much when you use low-fat versus whole milk?
Scott? Again, you're dealing with the fat. In
all these cases, you're cutting down fat, and fat, you're saying, is important. So
yes.
Do you have to have whole milk in your house if you only have low-fat, if you want to do baking of cakes?
I've always baked with whole milk. I don't have a lot of experience baking with low-fat milk. And to be honest, baking, as I know it, we use a lot of butter, a lot of eggs. So whole milk is about 3.25% to 4% fat. Low-fat milk, 1 or 2%. It's not a big difference.
A listener points out that spelt is not gluten-free.
Is it?
I kind of knew that, and I was kind of hedging my bet when I was saying what I was saying. But still...
Yeah.
There are reasons that people choose not to have wheat for us, also, and spelt is one of the things they substitute. A listener wonders about whether you can keep the fat content. He says, or she, can I improve the supermarket butter by heating it to draw off water? Will this have other side effects? Isn't that what what Indians do in their cooking?
Well, when they make ghee, when you heat ghee. Butter... You do remove some of the water. It's hard to estimate exactly when you've gotten it to be the 3% that you need. And if it gets a little too fatty, you also burn off some of the solids that are in there.
Now, Shirley, a number of people have written in to say that they are good cooks but not very confident bakers. That's because cooking... is a lot more improvisatory than baking, which is almost scientific. Recently, we've been seeing recipes that measure ingredients by weight rather than by a cup or a tablespoon. Is that because exactitude is necessary?
In some baking things, such as a cake, you do need a certain amount of, quote, exactitude. Mm. The proteins in the cake are the eggs and the flour. And they are the structure builders and build a form and shape and set with heat and hold gate. And the sugar and the fat are the moisturizers and the destroyers of structure. And these four ingredients have to be in some sort of balance for the cake to work. And actually, professional bakers have pretty firm formulas for this. With our modern the sweet cakes, it's the weight, and here, as you mentioned, this is weight, not volume. The weight of the sugar should equal or be greater than the weight of the flour. The weight of the eggs should be slightly more than the weight of the fat. And the weight of the liquid should be more than the weight of the sugar. This is so you'll have enough liquid to dissolve the sugar and dissolve, have some for the starch to swell.
Scott, do you weigh your ingredients?
Oh, always, always. It's just an easier way of measuring for me, and it takes a lot of the guesswork out. You know, flour, when you have a volume measurement of a dry ingredient like flour or chopped nuts, for example, there's air spaces in between, so you can get a variation on it.
We have barely scratched the surface, mm-hmm. unfortunately, because there's so many complications to baking. But my great thanks to my guest today for our Please Explain look at baking, Chef Scott McMillan, a pastry art instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education in Manhattan, and Shirley O'Carrer, whose book is Bake Wise, The Hows and Whys of Successful Cooking. Thank you both so much.